What if we could reimagine the traditional notion of a high flyer? Hey friends, welcome back or welcome to the High Flyers podcast, where we do reimagine a high flyer, showcase the brightest and most relatable role models and companies and their journey from sunrise to today. As one of the premier products in our Curiosity Center lineup, providing on-demand intelligence, featuring Olympic athletes, business and cultural leaders, students, journalists, investors, founders, and more from around the world to help you be 1% better every single day. I'm your host, Vidit Agarwal, and let's have some fun. Today, in this episode 128, I'm speaking with Peter Huynh. Learn about Peter's Vietnamese heritage, especially how his family moved to Sydney, Australia in the late 1970s and the early challenges they faced as his dad's medical degree was not recognized, meaning he had to study again, whilst Peter and his mum stayed in a small apartment with nine of their cousins in Wollongong. Peter's reflections, including learning English, watching TV shows on the ABC, are fascinating. Peter is well known for helping founders and investors with mindfulness coaching, so I had to ask him the source of this, and he candidly shares his own journey, including having teachers for almost 8 years to understand his true self. We unpack his career, including his most formative experiences with Hutchison and Singtel in the UK, Asia, and Australia, and working with early versions of Spotify and Facebook in 2008, and seeding the Australian startup ecosystem when it was just taking off in 2011. Peter has recently transitioned from a decade-long stint as a VC investor to become a startup executive, joining Harrison AI as their chief strategy officer. Hear about why he made the decision and his learnings working at the intersection of healthcare and AI. And listen through to the end of this episode for an exciting announcement of a special new product launching out of the Curiosity Center in May. It's now time to explore your curiosity. Please enjoy. Peter Huynh, welcome to the show.
Hi, Vidit. Great to be on the show. Thank you for inviting me.
Our previous guest, Will Richardson, speaks highly of you. And generally, when he speaks highly of someone, it's straight into the recording room. So really excited to do this. Why don't we start with some fun facts to set the scene. Where were you born and where do you live now?
I was born in the southern tip of Vietnam in a town called Rat Gia. And Rat Gia is a fishing town, and my ancestors for the past few generations have been fisher people. My dad was a doctor, and we made our way to Australia, to Sydney, in 1977. And I grew up in Sydney, but have lived in a number of places around the world since, working in tech. Right now, I'm living in Sydney. I've got my wife and two boys, 14-year-old and a soon to be 18-year-old. An 18-year-old in the house. We've lived in a few places around the world, but very happy to be calling Sydney home. And that's where our extended family is.
Amazing. I'd love to double click on some of those experiences shortly. And from a work perspective, what was your first job and what do you do now?
My first job was, I started working when I was in year 9 of high school. And my first job was to work in a photo lab, my uncle's photo lab at the time. And I was taught, how to take the film out of the canister, put it through processing, do the printing, end to end. So, I think it was wonderful to learn all those things and learn how to deal with customers at an early age.
And how would you describe your role now?
My role now, it's something that has changed fundamentally from what I had been doing for about roughly 10 years or so. Joining a company called Harrison AI. We essentially make software that is sort of helping clinicians with diagnosing and reading x-rays, CT scans, and soon to be biopsies as well. And so the fancy title is Chief Strategy Officer within the company, but I work across a whole number of activities, some of them operational in nature, some of them people related as well, supporting our head of PNC, working with our head of operations. But I spend most of my time on strategy related projects, which is, what are the different and new areas that we want to expand our technology into? And so right now we're in radiology, we're in pathology, and thinking about the other ologies, if you will, of where we could apply our AI technology.
And Pete, as you know, the purpose of this show is to reimagine a high flyer. I wonder, is there a high flyer you know who you feel hasn't got the recognition they deserve?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't really think of people in that sort of way. I suppose... in the Australian ecosystem, you've spoken to so many of my sort of friends and colleagues in the ecosystem. I wonder if someone like Sam Zheng would be, a person that I would suggest. Sam is the CEO and co-founder of a company called Curious Thing AI. Mm-hmm. I happen to be an investor and board director in that company. And he was also a co-founder of a company previously called HyperAnna. And what I love about working with Sam is just his courageous leadership and how he continues to evolve his leadership, constantly. And I've been on this journey with him for many years now. And just to see him continuing to evolve as a leader is something that, I take great inspiration from on my side. So perhaps someone to suggest on your end.
Sounds great. And I do follow his company. So that absolutely agree with that one. Now, Peter, I'd love to zoom back and go back to your sunrise. You sort of alluded to it earlier with Vietnam and the influences of family. But what are your memories of childhood?
Yeah, I had a difficult childhood. I think one of the most formative aspects of my childhood was, even though my father was a doctor in Vietnam, when we made our way to Australia, and it was a difficult journey, but that's another story in and of itself. When we made it to Australia, his medical degree was not recognized. Mm. And so he had to do his med degree again. During that time, of course, he was not able to work. And what we did was he would live in Newtown so that he could be close to the university. And then my mother and I moved to Wollongong to live with my uncles and aunts. And my mum would sew for a living, working from home to look after me. And so I lived in a two-bedroom flat in Wollongong for about 4 years or so, whilst Dad was doing his finishing off his study and doing his study. And there were 10 of us in that two-bedroom flat. And we were, we were struggling to get by. And so that sort of those formative years for me and actually not seeing Dad for that whole time, he would come back on weekends. Some weekends he couldn't. And so, to live away from him at that time, I was, I think, between the ages of 4 and 8, very formative years. I think that was a very difficult time for me. And I was a difficult child as well. Very precocious and, always wanting to put sort of more into the sponge that is in here. And so, I would have been a handful for my mum in particular. But that really sort of was quite significant in helping me form my views on the world. And then after that, life changed a lot. Once Dad graduated and was working as a doctor, we moved to Sydney and then we lived in Sydney from there on in. I've kept very strong personal bonds and ties with my uncles and aunts who I lived with at the time. They know me from such a young age and I spend a lot of time with them and we have this really close bond, having lived so closely together for those years. Life changed, so I know what it looks like to live on one end and then to live on the other end. It's made me, I guess, quite conscious of my good fortune And therefore conscious of always finding a way, but in whatever I can, whatever expression that may be, to continue to give.
Incredible. Thank you for candidly sharing that. Was it common for people to go from Vietnam to Australia, or did your parents consciously choose Australia as their next port of living?
No, it was very much by fate, by chance. And so at the end of the Vietnam War, a lot of Vietnamese left the country. Most of them went to the US or Europe, and some went to other parts of Asia as well, and some went to Australia. My father was actually waiting on his sort of application to make it to the US. We were waiting so long, we sort of made it to a refugee camp. And then when we were at the refugee camp, I think we were waiting for close to 3 months. And at that point in time, my dad became ill. He worked as an interpreter within that refugee camp to sort of help whilst he was there. And whilst we were waiting for the visa, during that time, he fell quite ill. And then he decided, actually, it's too dangerous to continue to wait. What could the other options be? And there was a small group from the Australian government there in the refugee camp. And they asked him what he did. And he said, well, actually, wonderful. You know, we need more of we need more doctors in the country. You know, why don't you think about Australia as an option? And he said, yep, would love to. And so that's how we made it to Australia. But that wasn't the original plan.
Yeah. And who would you say were your influences growing up? Was it your mum, or was it people you saw on TV or people at school?
Yeah, I was kind of brought up by by television in a lot of ways. That's how I learnt, English. We didn't have many books back then. I was a voracious reader for whatever I could get my hands on. But I guess I grew up very much in front of the TV at the time. And so, yeah, I was very much shaped by, time with my uncles and aunts, at that age. And then later on, very much my parents, my mum and dad. And they're the ones that sort of influenced me the most, apart from, the sort of heroes that I saw on TV and where I learned from. And I did watch a lot of, when I was growing up, I watched a lot of ABC and therefore a lot of BBC as a result. So a lot of those types of shows, and also a lot of SBS as well. Actually, I was sort of always drawn to ABC and SBS's, and sort of watching content from both of those channels growing up.
And if you fast forward to when you were maybe 18, where you've got some understanding of the world and of yourself, and as we know, you've done fairly well in your career. What were your aspirations from a life perspective? Did you have a goal that you felt would be success when you were 18?
Yeah, I mean, I was very different to who I am now. When I was an 18-year-old, I think I just wanted to, I wanted to be a part of the rat race. I wanted to fit in. I wanted to climb the ladder. I wanted to do all of those things. All of those aspects, now that I look back on it, of wanting to belong and trying to find a way to belong in this community, in this space, which felt quite alien to me, but at the same time I wanted to be so much a part of it. And so sort of adopting more of the sort of rituals and the the even the livery of wanting to be in that space. And so that was my ambition at the time. It wasn't really a specific goal in mind, but really a sense of just belonging.
You sound just like me. I moved from India when I was fairly young, and I tried for the longest time to get away from that identity, and to your point, try and run towards something. And now I look back on it and think how silly I was when I was a kid, so as most of us do. And one of the things that we'll touch later in the conversation is your mindfulness practice. Was that something that you came across when you were a kid, or did your parents or anyone in the family do that, or did you learn about it later in life?
Yeah, it's an interesting journey, because I've been exploring aspects of spirituality and religion for most of my life. And so my father grew up a Buddhist. I was actually more so Catholic on my end. And then when I was at university, joined friends to go to sort of Protestant church. And then after that, then took up meditation. And then for some time, becoming Buddhist myself. And then after that, getting to a point of just no religion at all. And so I don't subscribe to any particular religion, and I have not for many, many years now. But if I was to say, you know, what is sort of closest to my beliefs, it would be Buddhism. But even then, you know, I find that whilst the structures can be helpful and have been helpful for me over time, I've come to a point where I know this is going to sound, it's not going to sound exactly how I'd like it to, but I'll say it anyway. I found that I've in a way evolved beyond it. I don't need those structures anymore. And so, I figure that any structures that we put where we as human beings are sort of having to sort of impose those structures on others, I don't feel it's quite representative of the way that I see the world working. And so, yeah, there are aspects of religion that I think are super helpful for me, and there are aspects of religion that I don't find serve me well, and so I've dropped them.
Mm. And did you always have that realization, or did that come later in life?
Much later.
Yeah.
It was a search, an ongoing search for a long time, and I realized in or around the time that my eldest was born, you know, in and around 2005, at that time was the time that I realized that I had evolved beyond that and didn't really need those structures anymore. But I'd always been on the search, and I'd always been curious, and I continue to be curious. And you know, this could evolve again in time to come.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned earlier that when you were 18, you didn't have a clear goal or destination in life. So how did you decide on what to study at university?
I just decided on, you know, what to study because I thought that was the cool thing to do. So studying law was, you know, sort of, you know, if you could do that, then that's what you would do. And so that's why I ended up studying. But I found out, and I got to work in a law firm, you know, as a clerk, you know, one of those things, you know, when I was quite early in university, and I didn't enjoy it, and it didn't suit me, and I didn't suit them. And so I figured out at that point in time that that type of work wasn't for me. I was looking for something that was much more at a pace that suited me better, and that was evolving much faster. And that was technology for me. That's, you know, that's where I wanted to be, and that's what I ended up learning. And so my first job in technology was to work at Computer Sciences Corporation, which is a large, I guess, a systems integration firm. And I got to work on large projects for them. And I, you know, at the time, you know, it was all sort of waterfall development and, you know, PRINCE2 methodology and sort of building large enterprise systems, which actually, if I sort of look back, was a fantastic and very helpful grounding because you get to learn how to do things at super large scale. And then to learn, you know, years later, how that evolves into agile, you know, extreme, then into agile. You know, you've kind of like learned the fundamentals. It's almost like, you know, being a part of the sort of kitchen brigade system and learning sort of the fundamentals of that before, and then learning sort of how to do the sort of basics of sort of French cooking before learning molecular. It's kind of like that in a way, right? You sort of learn how to do this at a really large scale and, you know, in sort of this big monolithic way, and then how things get done much, much faster.
Back to the episode in a moment. We've been very fortunate to feature some of the brightest and most relatable minds, including Startmate CEO Michael Batko in episode 57, Matt Allen from Tractor Ventures in episode 78, and Laura Henshaw from Keep Cleaner in episode 111, all there waiting for you. Talk about your experience at Hutchison, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. I imagine that was one of the magic asterisk moments, joining them, and you were with them for almost a decade. How did you join them, and then are there any highlights that stick out from that period of time?
Hutchison, I don't have enough high praise for that company, that group. It is, I think it's the most sort of formative place that I've ever worked, and it continues to influence me today. And it taught me so much. And the reason why I was able to work there was when I was still in sort of agency land, working in a digital agency and leading the operations for a digital agency, I got to work with some ex-McKinsey folks there as well. And then one of them introduced me to the person who led sales and marketing at Hutchison 3 Mobile in Sydney. And so he brought me across to lead all the sort of digital aspects of that business. And then my role evolved from there, from that into product and then into strategy and biz dev, corp dev over in the UK. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just the culture there was one of a relatively small team, given great autonomy, great support from a leadership development perspective, and great scope, a great canvas to do your very best work. And I've brought that along with me with every role since, holding the space for the people that I work with to do their very best work and to give great trust for them to do that. And so, you know, I remember there was a point in time when I was in London and we were negotiating a particular contract with Google. And, another telco had been in there. I worked in the telco part of the business mostly. And so another telco had been in there just before us, and they had 12 people on their end in the meeting.
Oh, wow.
and we're sort of in the lobby, and there's only two of us. And this is for a global negotiation for a global arrangement. And the person on the Google side, well, where's the rest of the team? It's like, well, it's just us. and so it was just the nature of the scope that you were given, the trust that you were given. You had to do good work, but everybody around you was fantastic and supportive. And so that type of culture and that investment in leadership development, by the way, is something that I continue to today.
I'd love to ask you about that time working with some of these tech companies in a second. But before that, did Hutchison have a connection with Vodafone? Am I right in understanding
that?
Yeah,
although that happened when I was no longer in the business. So right. I was in the UK during the time when that, I think, merger occurred. And so, yeah, I wasn't sort of in Australia when that happened. But yes, that's right. That's the same organization. And it's actually a part of a group in Hong Kong called Hutchison Whampoa.
Hmm.
Hutchison Whampoa is an incredible company. It's from Hong Kong, but it is a conglomerate in so many different spaces, ports and shipping, of course, development, utilities of all different types, retail. It's the single largest foreign investor in all of Western Europe. That's something that most folks don't know, and the single largest foreign investor in the UK. So it's a huge group, but most folks don't know about them. And they, they provide a platform for a lot of people to sort of elevate their careers.
And did that feel like a chance to reconnect with your Asian heritage in any way when you were at that firm?
That's a good question. Yes and no. I mean, it sort of doesn't feel overtly Asian, even though the headquarters is in Hong Kong and it's sort of, it's founded in Hong Kong. Of course, the founder himself is Mr. Lee from Hong Kong. Not really. It has such an international culture, folks from all around the world and working on various projects. Not really. Maybe it was the start. It took me a little bit of time to sort of reconnect to that part of myself, and but once I did, I wanted to do more of it, and that's what led me to setting up a VC firm with the goal of investing in the region.
Yeah, and if I can ask a question, you mentioned earlier about Google, and I heard you say on another podcast that you also worked with Facebook and Twitter, And this is a, it was a really interesting period because 2008 is when a lot of these companies were just getting traction and they weren't the behemoths they are today. I wonder if you can share an experience or two that stands out from that time that maybe surprised you, or you look back on it and you're like, wow, I never thought these companies would get as big as they are today.
One of them was Spotify. I remember because Horizons are in, and that's sort of the lease fund, Horizons are investors in Spotify, relatively early investors in Spotify at that.
Right.
I think it would have been in 2009, so quite early investors. And then after that time, there was the push of Spotify expanding from, I think it was first in, of course, Sweden and the Nordics, and then I think expanded into France and then into the UK. And as it was expanding into the UK, you know, this would have been late 2009 into 2010. So I had a Spotify, I've had a Spotify account since then, you know, sort of late 2009. And, you know, you kind of knew what was coming down the line, but, you know, to see it so ubiquitous today is, you know, I still have to pinch myself. But I remember that drive of, you know, the business expanding into the UK, expanding through one of the relationships that we had, and we had them sort of preloaded on some phones and in some plans and that type of thing to help with the sort of push to launch in the UK. So yeah, it was great to sort of see that journey and see how, of course, these services that they kind of at the time it felt like, oh, this is an awesome secret. This is an awesome secret that as people find out, they're going to really love. And so I think that whenever I've sort of had that sort of sense that, oh, wow, what I'm using right now feels like an amazing secret that I wish everybody knew about, that's when you kind of have this sense that this is really going to take off.
And was that your first date almost with venture capital in some way?
In a way, I mean, you know, working with these sort of large tech firms gave me that that exposure. I got to do a project with the Facebook mobile team in 2009, and it was a really small team. It was like five folks, but that was a real eye-opener for me. That's when I really learned about things like MVPs, just getting to market as quickly as possible, build, test, learn. I mean, you know, there were no books on this back then. You know, there was no Lean Startup, the book. It was just a bunch of blog posts and stuff that we would end up learning later. And you're right, but that's when I got that exposure to how things get done super fast. And I was addicted. I was absolutely addicted from that time. It's like, wow, I can't do anything else now. I just want to do this for, ongoing. And so everything that I did was now getting into how businesses can be built in a different way, in a more effective way, in a faster way. That changed the trajectory of what I wanted to do.
Peter, I'd love to go into 2011. I think that's when you joined Singtel. And something that I think a lot about is career moves and career changes. And you seem like someone who's very intentional with what you do in life. I would imagine at that point you're sort of mid-career. I think you'd been in your career for close to 10 years, if my maths is right. Where were you at in your career? Did you feel you were senior? Were you still coming up the ranks? And part two, if I can, how did you decide that, okay, it's time for a new challenge?
That was a little bit more straightforward because we wanted to come back to Sydney from the UK. And so in coming back, you know, what you mentioned before about Vodafone and Hutchison merging, coming back, you know, the shape of that organization, it wasn't sort of working on the things that I was fundamentally interested in. And so, you know, I was on a search to find, you know, and I was in no rush. I was in a search to find what, you know, what that could be. And, I got to connect with the folks at Singtel and Optus, and they were saying, well, come work here. We're doing some interesting things. And, you know, we're looking to do more in this space. And so that's why I joined the organization. And it was a wonderful learning opportunity and platform. And so, you know, I got the chance to contribute to things like being the first, large corporate sponsor for fish burners. You know, at the time they were less than a year old, and when we did the deal, that would fund them for about 3 years, and so it helped them expand into first building and expand their operations and that type of thing. And so supporting the first few startup weekends that ever happened in Australia, and sharing the message and supporting the ecosystem in that way, setting up the sort of first sort of seed fund, investing in seed stage startups. This was in 2011. This was quite a while ago. And then being more involved after sort of setting up those things, being more involved on the Singtel corporate venture capital side and helping with other investments as well, not only in Australia, but in different parts of the world. So, yeah, I mean, it was intentional in the sense that once I became exposed to the way that businesses were being built, I wanted to be a part of that in some way. And I figured that being a supporter, being an investor, that's the direction that I wanted to move in.
Yeah, that did come up in my research, where I believe yourself and Alfred Lowe were involved even in the York Butter Factory. It was, I think, another one that you were significantly involved in. So kudos to you for playing a big role in planting the seeds in the early days, and we are where we are now, 11 years later.
No, not at all. I mean, it's I think there's so many of us from that time. We all felt that we were on a mission to build the industry, the community in Australia. And we wanted technology to be the leading industry in Australia, all of us. I remember actually Alfred and I and a few other friends and Nikki Shavak had dinner a few months ago and reminiscing about the time when, for the very first Blackbird Sunrise event, I think Nikki and Rick just came back from a trip to, I forget where it was, somewhere in the Northern Territory. And then they came back and they were like, oh, we want to do this event, but we're not quite sure, where we're going to get the money from. And they came to Alfred and I as the sort of first folks that they spoke to. And they said, would you be open to sponsoring this event? You know, this is kind of like what we're thinking of. And we were like, yeah, absolutely. We'd love to do it. And so we ended up being the first corporate sponsors for Sunrise. And to see where it is now is just incredible. So being a part of the, sort of the formation of these things is incredible. The other thing is the StartMate Fellowship. I remember when it was just an idea from James Tynan, and he was like, okay, this is what I'm thinking of doing. What do you think? And we were sort of thinking about all the different mechanics of the process and the program and how it would run. And so to be there at the very start of StartMate Fellowship and to see what it's evolved to today, it's something that, and when folks just, that I bump into talk about, I'm like, wow, it's quite incredible to have been there at the start of these things.
Something that I try and do with this podcast is shine a light on some of these people who the broad audience might not know about. I wonder if are there any people from that period in 2011, 2012 that you want to call out or recognize that aren't as public with their work that we should recognize their efforts in building this ecosystem?
I mean, all of the StartMate mentors from around that time, some of them are well known, some of them are not so well known. I think at the time, I started StartMate 2012 was the first cohort that I worked with, and there were about 33 mentors at the time. I don't know what it is now, but, I think it's much, much larger group. But those folks back then, I mean, the effort and time and energy that we would put into to help founders, and we do it because we want to build this rising tide that will lift all boats. We didn't care about what it meant for our own business or our own sort of interests. It was never even thought of, and so all those folks sort of doing many different things these days. It's sort of more than 10 years later, but they're all formative. So those OG, I guess they call them the OG StartMate mentors. I tip my hat off to every single one of them because they've all put in so much time, energy and effort to help build this ecosystem.
I was just about to say that even the founders that went through the first StartMate Accelerator, there's some of the most OG companies that are still out of any StartMate Accelerator. So absolutely. And it sounds like your experience at this up till this point in 2011, 12, 13 was still quite in the Western world, whereas Australia, the UK. When did you first start, I guess, reintegrating yourself back into the South Asian ecosystem and understanding business there? When did that start?
Yeah, so even during this time, you know, I would travel to Singapore quite readily. You know, Singtel is headquartered in Singapore, so I'd be right. traveling back and forth between Sydney and Singapore. It was during that time that I started to reconnect more with the region. And that's when I met, you know, the co-founders in the fund that we would end up setting up. And I think I'd always had it as a part of my mission to reconnect and to build stronger business ties and connections between Australia and the region, particularly Vietnam. And this was one expression of that. I've also been an advisor to a group called the Australian Vietnamese Leadership Dialogue, which helps to identify emerging leaders in both countries and then hold events where they can spend time with each other whilst they're sort of in their sort of emergent paths as leaders, so that they have a greater cultural understanding when they become, you know, senior leaders. That started, you know, I think roughly 2015 timeframe there or thereabouts. But that's another program that I'm a part of. But then Qualgrow, which is my venture capital fund, that was really an expression of that wanting to sort of build a bridge in a way and support founders across both Australia and the Southeast Asian region, and you know, having a fund that invested in both and tying them all together.
I've asked you a few questions about your career moves, and there's a few more moves coming up that we'll talk in a second, but I'd love to zoom out and talk about some of your routines and habits. And one thing that kept coming up in my research is you've got this awesome ability to understand how people are feeling and to connect and to make people calm and settled and not overanalyze. Mm. And if I think about my career for a second, I learned a lot of these traits about me and about others through adversity. Mm. So either through redundancy or being just messing it up or getting really bad feedback. And that was my learning journey. And I'm really grateful I went through that. Mm. I'd be curious, Peter, what was it for you? Maybe you were always like that and you just had an ability to connect with people and understand their deeper, darker secrets. But was there a moment or was it a person or a project you worked on that made you realize the importance of understanding the person as much as the work they do?
Mm, yeah, I mean, I've worked with a number of teachers over time. My first teacher, her name was Sarah Lovett, and she was a barrister quit the law and became a teacher full time. And she was my first teacher. And she really helped me to sort of guide me back on the journey back to self. And so I suppose if I can cast my awareness back inwards and understand my journey back and back to the core of who I am, then the corollary of that is also helpful, where I'm casting myself out and connecting with folks on the other end and seeing them hopefully for who they are, and seeing, you know, them as they genuinely are through the work that I've done. It's deep work to understand the core of who I am. And so that is where it comes from. But it's kind of, I call it work because it actually is work. It's quite intensive work to work on self and to be on that journey for an extended period of time. So I worked with Sarah for about 2.5 years, quite intensively. And then my next teacher for about 2 years as well. And then another teacher after that for another 2 years. So it's a lot of time, work and energy in doing that work on self. And then after that, I started to do really my teaching, working with founders and working with investors and doing my mindfulness mentorship after that point in time. And I did that mentorship for about 5 years, every Sunday, you know, for about 3 hours or so, working with three different investors or founders just through that period. And I've since taken a sabbatical from that work, but I started that work, I think it was in 2017, and only finished that work partway through last year.
Back to the episode in a moment. I mentioned at the start that there's an exciting announcement to share. We're pumped to be announcing a series of live fireside chats in May with leading investors from Blackbird, SquarePeg, and more. Follow us on social media to be notified when tickets go on sale. All links are in the show notes. I wonder if you could put some practicalities around some of that. If we say hypothetically, say we've met for the first time, how would you, and I don't know if you want to answer this question, all good if you don't, how do you build that? This is something I think a lot about. How do you build that trust in that first conversation? And this is not investor founder. It could be a friend, could be a family member, could be a work colleague. Maybe we can use Harrison as an example. When he joined the company, I imagine you had a lot of one-on-ones. What are there specific questions you ask? Or do you give people a brief, or do you do it in a certain environment? I'm just really curious, like, are there things that you've done practically that work?
I keep it simple. I start from a place of curiosity. I want to know how the person in front of me thinks about themselves. How do they think about who they are, what their expression is in the world, what they have learned about themselves or continue to learn about themselves, what they're working on in terms of self. That gives me a sense of who it is in front of me. And so I start with those things because I'm trying to find that core, in the person in front. I'm actually not trying necessarily to, in inverted commas, build trust. I'm not trying to, in inverted commas, build credibility, those types of things. I don't have any other agenda. In fact, I clear myself of all other agenda apart from connecting, understanding, and to whatever extent that I can, knowing the person in front of me to whatever extent is possible within the time that we have. Because that 30 or 40 minutes is... a very short amount of time. But then again, so is 3 months working with a person. If you zoom out in the sort of, context of the cosmos, that 3 or 4 months that I spend with a founder is in many ways a blink of an eye as well. But the motion is the same. What I'm trying to do is see the person that's there.
I imagine you'd be a master of sorts now at catching your own behavior, like when you're stressed or you're frustrated or low energy or what have you. I'm curious, what are the behaviors that you do when you catch yourself in moments of stress or frustration, like any human does? We're all human. Are there practices you do? Like, do you go away and meditate, or do you go out in nature? Like, say if you're on an office day and you've been in back-to-back meetings and they're really frustrating meetings with a lot of challenges, how do you ground yourself back? Like, what's that practice for you during the workday?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is just to acknowledge it and to check in. And so one of the practices that, for folks that work with me, I ask them to do as the first of muscles to build is to ask yourself this question, once or twice a day, how am I physically feeling? And to have the answer come up like a reflex. There's no need to really think about it. How am I physically feeling? I'm hangry or whatever it might be. First of all, acknowledging where you're at, checking in on where you're at, checking in on where your body's at. This physical vessel in which we're experiencing the world in is so important. One is acknowledgement, and two is then, decide what you want to do about it, whatever is helpful for you, whether you want to, take a few deep breaths, 4 or 5 deep breaths, or go for a walk, or whatever it might be. There was a situation actually in the office last week whereby, I think it was a high stress situation, and I reacted to a comment in a way that wasn't really constructive. It was more like out of frustration, and I'm human as well, so I'd done it. I caught myself sort of doing it. But then straight afterwards, I was like, okay. Of course, the best thing is to acknowledge it and apologize, and that's what I did. And so, you're absolutely right. I mean, just because I do this work, and for all the folks who do this work and by that work, I mean the work on self, it doesn't mean that I'm perfect by any stretch. And far from it. But hopefully, what I have are the tools to help me to deal with self in a way that is helping to continue to evolve and integrate and build and create. And that's what I'm looking to do. And so it's also, you know, the sort of a misunderstanding to think that for folks who do this work that they don't feel, right? Because you're able to process anger, you know, maybe faster or whatever it might be, that you don't feel it. No, I absolutely do feel it. Hopefully I've built practices and tools to help me to process that anger better, knowing where it sits, knowing where it resides. In a metaphorical sense, sitting with that anger, understanding why that's there, understanding the job that it's looking to do, forgiving myself for feeling that way and giving myself permission to let it go, and therefore processing that anger in a way that is constructive and moves through perhaps faster than otherwise.
I'm keen to spend some time on Harrison. One last question before we get to that is, you mentioned earlier about having two kids, one's 18. What is their relationship like with mindfulness and some of these practices that you've realized they're integral to your life? Do you spend time educating them about it?
Yeah, I've tried. Right. But the interest levels aren't really there, not at this point in time. But I think they'll come to it in their own time. They know that this is something that is a part of who I am and what I do. And so, you know, they know that I can share with them all of the practices. And, you know, by trying, I mean, like, we've actually sat down and I've done guided meditations for them, that type of trying. But, you know, the interest is not high, and they'll come to it in time. And, you know, I don't blame them. And when I was 14 and 18, I wasn't spending my time meditating either.
Well, if I can give you any solace, Mum would nag me about meditation for years, and I think I only started doing it last year, and it's been life-changing. Mum would go, do it, and I'd go, why do I need it? I am good, and I'm tough, and you do all those things that many of us humans do, and you're right. It's got to come from within sometimes, and once you do it, you realize the benefits. I'd love to go into your, I imagine this is another magic moment for you, Peter, is your move from being a venture investor for many, many years to going back to wanting to build a company and partnering with founders. And if my research is correct, you spent almost a decade at Qualgrow building that fund in Australia and Southeast Asia. I wonder if you can candidly share, what was that magic moment or thoughts or conversations that gave you the energy to go, hey, actually, you know what? I've met this company and I really connect with these founders and I want to partner with them full time.
Qualgrow started in 2015, so it was sort of 7 years. And then prior to that, of course, I'd been a part of corporate venture capital at Singtel Group. So it's actually, you know, roughly 10 years, maybe even a little bit more actually than that within the venture space. And so I was doing the calculations, I think, a few months ago. I've met, during the time at Qualgrow, roughly 500 companies a year. For those 7 years, so that's 3,500 companies, and we've invested in, I think, about 34 of them, there or thereabouts. And I was on the board for 12 of them, I believe, at one point in time, not anymore. I love all the companies that we've invested in, and certainly the teams that I've spent time with. But there's never been a point in time where I said to myself, actually, I want to leave venture capital and join this particular team right now. That feeling was never there. I mean, I always ask my question, would I work for the founders, that type of thing. And the answer would be, yes, these are the founders that, you know, theoretically, if I was looking to do this work, in this space, I would work for. But it's very different from, would I leave what I'm doing right here, right now, and drop everything and join this company? And there's only one company that's ever made me feel that way, and that's Harrison. And so, you know, spending time with Angus and Dimitri Tran, the co-founders and brothers who formed and founded Harrison, I met them when it was just the two of them and a computer. Before too long was providing them with some mentoring and advice from time to time, and then they wanted to formalize that a little bit more, and I would spend actually more time with them being more sort of formally an advisor and a mentor, and not only mentoring them, but over the years sort of mentoring them and then mentoring different parts of the executive group for quite a while, probably about 2 years or so before I joined. And so I had a great sense of what the company was about. I certainly was coming in with eyes very wide open. I mean, the both of them together are absolutely magical. The shape of company that we're looking to build in terms of truly creating a space where people can do their life's work, creating a culture that is diverse and inclusive, highly performant, and mindful is a dream. As I look at our board and our executive team and, you know, the way we do the things that we do, I can't help but be so very proud. And to have a hand in helping to shape some of it is an absolute joy. So I feel like I'm exactly where I'm meant to be. And that, this sort of transition from venture into working within an operating company and in my own words, doing some real work for a change. it's something that I feel sort of the next expression of who I am in this world is to do this work with this company right now. And so it was almost a no-brainer when Dimitri and Angus asked me to join full-time that I said, yeah, I'd love to. This is where I'm meant to be.
We're recording this in April 2023, so I think it's 3 months into the role, if I'm correct. What surprised you so far just about the transition at an individual level? I'm sure you went in with certain expectations given you worked with so many founders, but then, as you know, until you're in the chair, you don't really know reality day to day. Is there a surprise that you didn't expect?
This is such a great question. The surprise isn't in relation so much to the business, which I knew really well, and I knew all of the challenges and the strengths and all those sorts of things coming in. The surprising thing was my own sort of trying to fit in within the space of a day-to-day role within a company. And by that I mean I'm so used to the context switching of, in one day having, five, six, seven different conversations across five, six, seven different companies and very different issues at different life cycle stages. And I built muscles over the last 10 years or so of doing that relatively well. Now, I could quickly context switch and be in the mode. But what happens is, at least for me, I can do that, but I'm operating at a certain level of depth within each particular company. And of course, you will always only be able to do that from an investor's perspective. You're never day to day. And now switching the mental muscles, if I can put it that way, of going, super deep as possible, as detailed as possible in one company at any given point in time is something that I'm still working on. Now, I knew that would be a challenge, but not to the extent that it is. It's almost like there's a part of me that's sort of craving an element of, I wish I could sort of context switch a bit more and, look at a few different other, business models and problems. And, and then at the same time, there's a part of me that's saying, actually, I want to go deeper. I need to go deeper. I want to go deeper. And so I'm in that settling in process right now. And I haven't cracked it. I'm partway through it. And so, being able to even sort of intentionally construct my diary so that I'm going deeper on particular issues and, working them through and closing them out with the team, that type of thing, rather than having a scattered calendar, which I'm really used to, because you can context switch even within an organization as well, through a bunch of different parts of the business, so on and so forth. And my initial, my initial move was actually just habitual just to do that. And of course, early on, it's helpful because it helps you to get an even better lay of the land. But now I'm finding that actually I need to and I want to go much deeper. And so, constructing my time and organizing my time around that is something that I'm working on right now.
Fascinating. I'm excited to see the development you have in the next 3-6 months at a personal level and how that evolves. I spoke to your head of operations, Matt Galita, prior to this, who is a good friend, and he said ask Peter about how advanced some of the Harrison AI solutions are, but also how you are merging that with some of the government regulations that perhaps are catching up with the innovation. I wonder if there's anything you want to share there. It's a broad question, but anything you're learning or you want to share with our audience about some of your solutions and then merging that with government regulations?
Yeah, I mean, it's a massive challenge within, not just within sort of the health tech space, but even within AI more broadly. And so just as an example, our product, we have a product in radiology for that reads chest x-rays. And our product in that sort of reads sort of chest x-rays, it can identify 124 different indications, different conditions that it can pick up on reading the x-ray itself. And so it's been cleared for use for clinical use in Australia and in about 38 countries around the world. But as we try to go through the US for FDA clearance, in the US it's different because this sort of notion of an AI tool, an AI diagnostic tool that can identify that many, you know, that number of indications within an X-ray, is something that's really difficult for that regulatory body, and there are probably other regulatory bodies who have this difficulty as well, right, to even contemplate. And so the way that we've had to do the clearance in the US is to do it almost like, initially one at a time, one condition at a time. So imagine 124 of them just in serial at a time. Now it's happening in little groups. And so I believe we've got sort of 9 clearances at the moment. But you know, this is where when we are at the leading edge of something and regulation is having to find a way to catch up, this is, you know, this is a great example of that. And I'm sure we'll end up in a great place and we'll find a way to do these clearances in batches and move forward more quickly. But in the meantime, you know, we have a solution, for example, that we can sell in its sort of full functionality, full capability in Europe, in the UK, in Australia, in most parts of Asia. But in order to sell that product in the US, we would have to cut back on what it's functionally able to do, because the way that it is cleared, you know, hasn't really caught up yet. And so this is, and I'm sure this example probably manifests itself in many, many other ways across not only AI, but other parts of technology as well. But I think most acutely in AI, where regulation is really struggling to catch up.
Yeah, I think you're in a really interesting crossroads because the intersection of AI and healthcare is so interesting and there's so many use cases. I spend a lot of my time reading about it and you're living it. You're sort of the man in the arena is very cool. So I'm sure a lot of people would be coming to you for advice on how they can use AI in their business. We've got a few minutes left, Peter, so I'd love to close with a quick rapid fire sprint. Is there one investment you've made that you consider the best in your life, non-financial?
Non-financial investment. That is such a great question. I'm not sure. Non-financial investment. I know this is going to sound really self-centered, and I don't want it to come across this way. But actually, my biggest non-financial investment has been my investment in my own evolution, because as I've done that, I've become a better partner, a better father, a better son, you know, a better colleague. So that investment, and by the way, it's expensive, right? To have, sort of work with teachers for X years at a time, to put in, all the sort of money and effort that I put into that work. It's been extensive, but it's been the most impactful by a long way. So that would be sort of the investment in my own self-development.
Hmm. one thing you'd like to learn in the next 6 months?
Ooh, one thing I'd like to learn. I'd like to, just from a technology perspective, I'd like to learn more about, you know, actually, it's not even technology. I'm on this sort of crusade to learn more about just medicine and anatomy. Because I come from a technology space and I'm working in medical AI. I've been investing in AI companies for quite a while now. So on the technology side, I feel like I've got, I mean, there's still more to learn. Don't get me wrong. But the part that I'm sort of missing, I get lost in sort of internal conversations, is when we talk about a whole range of, you know, medical terms and anatomy and those sort of things. And so, you know, I'm going to borrow some of my dad's textbooks and and read up on anatomy, and that's the mission I'm on at the moment. I've been doing that just using some online tools, but you know, I'm going to do some proper, in inverted commas, study of those things.
And that's actually really interesting. We spoke at the start about your doctor, about your dad being a doctor, and how he had to work his way, and now you are in that space in a business sense. So yeah. It's funny how life comes full circle in that way. And last question, Peter, is there a person, a quote that inspires you today?
Yeah, I mean, there's that that quote around, I used to know it cold, but you know, the space between stimulus and response, the Viktor Frankl.
Yep, yep.
And I, you know, it's something that is so true. You know, if you can find that sort of space between stimulus and response, that for me is where growth comes from. That's where being in the moment really is. That's where you find out who you are at any given point in time. And if you think about that space almost like a fractal for the rest of your life, the way that you interact with yourself and others within that space is the way that I find that life plays out. And so I can't quite recall the quote off the top of my head at this point in time, but that's a quote that has always resonated deeply with me.
I have heard that quote, and it's amazing. But that's the finish line, Peter. Thank you so much for joining me, and wish you all the very best.
Thank you.
I hope you took away some actual insights and learnings from this conversation to apply to your life and continue to be 1% better. If you're enjoying the show, I'd love to hear from you. You can either share a rating or review on your podcast app, or contact me directly via email or any of our social media pages. All links are in the show notes. Talk soon.